Conference record has joined the conference.
Okay, thank you. Good morning, everyone, and welcome to our second meeting of our Managed Long-Term Care Implementation Work Group. And I hope that we can fit in all of the people who came. We're trying to squeeze in chairs here. Let me just make sure we go around and introduce the members of our work group, starting with my co-chair.
Tom Holt.
Kathy Schuer.
Melanie Shaw.
Alan Morris.
Betty Mollinger-Croza.
Joe Healy.
David McNally.
My name is Helen Shaw. I'm here for your refreshment.
Joanne Constantino.
Kay Ball.
Courtney Burke.
Michael Burnbaum.
Carol Brodat.
Mary Harper.
Mark Lane.
Mark Kissinger.
Felicia Boyd.
Jason Hutterson.
Okay, and I know Marilyn Saviola is here and will be joining us momentarily. So I'd like to just review what we want to try to accomplish today. We hope during our session today to reach consensus about our what we're calling our care coordination model principles. We shared those with you. I believe you all received copies yesterday, but we will make sure that you have copies at your place today as well. So that is our goal for today, to try to reach that consensus. In addition, we've had to make some changes to our schedule. Originally, we had set up September 20th for the next meeting, but because there's going to be a full meeting of the Medicaid redesign team on that day, we've had to make some changes. And the next meeting, and Mark, please make sure I'm giving this information accurately, is going to be on September 28th. And prior to that, on September 19th, we are going to have a public session where we will invite members of the public to speak to us about the principles that hopefully will be in a second iteration by that point. We will also today establish several subcommittees, and the subcommittees will be in three areas. I'm going to be chairing a subcommittee that will work on what should be the quality measures and how will we know we have been successful in really redesigning a very strong long-term care system in this state. Eli is going to chair a subcommittee on fair hearings. And then I have been asked by the other work group that has already been launched that's working on state and local roles and responsibilities going forward, if we could kind of co-organize a work group that they are setting up. They're looking at what the role of the county will be in the future in regard to eligibility and enrollment in long-term care for Medicaid beneficiaries. And they thought that issue was a crossover with what we are doing here. And so they're moving quickly, and they would like us to nominate several people who can join that work group, and I hope to be able to do that as well today. So before we launch, I wanted to ask Jason Helgerson to spend some time briefing us on the Medicaid redesign team writ larger and where we are overall. So welcome, Jason.
Well, thank you. It's great to be here. I'm trying to get around to attend at least one of the work group sessions for all 10 of the work groups. This is going to consume a good amount of my time in order to be able to get there. But I want to first off thank all of you who are here and participating. Taking time out of your busy schedules, and without compensation from us, some of your organizations are incurring costs to allow you to be here to help us in this very, very important effort. This was a work group that was envisioned for really very early on as part of the MRT process. We knew full well that while we had a desire and the MRT committee endorsed an approach to move to mandatory managed long-term care, we knew that as we looked at some of the populations that had been excluded from that program in the past, that there was going to be a lot of work necessary to really make sure that the program evolved to meet the needs of those unique populations. And I think that's really what you've been tasked to do. You know, I look forward to the discussion about these guiding principles because I really think it's going to be important as Valencia and Mark and staff begin the process of putting together that November 15th document, which will really be providing clear direction to the state in terms of moving forward with implementation of mandatory managed long-term care. But I also wanted to take just a few minutes to give you an update on what else is going on. MRT is, you are one of 10 work groups that have either been established or are in the process of being established. We've been releasing the work groups in waves. You were part of the first wave. Primarily the reason for that approach has been just it's a lot of work to try to not only prepare and staff to the work groups, but logistically and then from a number of different perspectives to try to manage the work associated with 10 individual work groups. That said, I think we're making steady progress. The launch of the final second wave membership and scheduling the first meeting is happening this week. The final three work groups, which will be associated with the medical malpractice reform, workforce development, and also housing, affordable housing or supportive housing, will be the last three to launch, but we definitely intend to get those up and running before the end of the month of August. But hopefully, we are also staggering the final report dates, and I just wanted to mention to you that we're in the process of putting together a report template that we will be sharing with the co-chairs and then also with all of you to give you a flavor of what the final report is, what they're hoping you'll be able to generate will look like. Give you a sense of it. I think one important thing is the more specific your recommendations are, the more helpful it is and the more likely it is that we'll be able to implement your recommendations as you approve them. Always one of the challenges there that the less specific a recommendation, the more open to interpretation it is in the implementation phase. So I would encourage you to think about trying to. That said, not all recommendations will come in the same format. Some will be very specific policy changes that the state should have. In your case, given the nature of the charge here of advising us on implementation, I think that one of an excellent final work product of this group would be the guiding principles on what the care coordination model should be. So I'm very, having talked to the co-chairs in advance, I'm very happy to hear that that's been such an important focus. In terms of how this work group then feeds into the full MRT, the full MRT, as was mentioned, has a meeting scheduled and apologize for having to push a meeting of this important group. But the idea is to meet in September 20th, in Albany, to have basically at that meeting we'll update the full MRT, which will have some new members, on the status of the current implementation of phase one proposals. We'll also give an update in terms of where we are at relative to the global spending cap. We'll have a good amount of data under our belt at that point, so we'll be able to give everyone an update on that. And then also what we're going to do is give each of the co-chairs an opportunity to give an update to their colleagues in terms of the status of each of the work groups. It will be an opportunity, I think, for the co-chairs to sort of brief the rest of the committee and give them an early insight in terms of what the recommendations might look like, or at least the updates on the focus of each of the work groups at that September 20th meeting. Not big elaborate reports, but we're thinking maybe 5 to 10 minutes per work group to get a sense of what progress is being made. And then in terms of the next meeting of the MRT, the next focus of the MRT will really be to review the recommendations of the work groups such as this. Our plan is to basically probably break up the work group recommendations into two distinct MRT meetings. Those meetings will, the first one probably in the late October to early November timeframe, and then the final meeting on the late November, early December timeframe. We'll have just those meetings depending on the status of the work groups. Hopefully, if everyone stays on time, we'll be able to adjust that, be able those targets. For this group, that would mean that most likely we would be looking to present, have the co-chairs on behalf of this work group present the recommendations of this group at that very first meeting. As I said, the late October, early November timeframe. And the idea would be that would be a fairly comprehensive presentation of the recommendations, the process that went through. Our plan would be to provide that report to the full MRT as well as publish it to the web in advance of the meeting so that the public as well can see the recommendations. And that, as is always the case with the MRT meetings, the meeting always means full effect of the public. We will strive to also webcast them so that a broader audience will have access to the content. Our hope is that all your work will be endorsed by a vote by the MRT, and then the idea then is that our hope is that the rest of the work plans, all 10 of the MRT work groups will be endorsed by the MRT, and then forwarded on to the governor for his consideration. The timing, and I've got a lot of questions about timing, and why are we rushing, and things like that, but our hope all along has been that this basically phase two of the MRT process would advise the governor on the development of his proposed budget, which is really our next major vehicle to sort forward some of these additional reform proposals. And so the governor and our friends at the Division of Budget like to remind me that giving them enough time to draft proposals is very important. Those of us who lived through phase one and the drafting, when we had about 6 days to try to draft 73 proposals and try to get those into the governor's 30-day amendment, realized that giving ourselves a little bit more time to do it properly would be extremely helpful. So I just wanted to give folks that's kind of where we're at. We feel overall that we're doing quite well on this phase too, and I think a lot of that really credit to the fact that not only are our co-chairs doing a great job of leading these work groups, but also the members are being active participants. I've been amazed at the degree to which this process has actually evolved. As mentioned here at Long-Term Care, creating work subgroups. Your colleagues over on behavioral health have certainly set the standard. They have quite a few subgroups that are meeting. They've been very active. Other groups are doing the same. I've also been pleased to hear about the coordination across work groups, the fact that Ann Monroe picked up the phone and called Carol Raphael and said, you know, we've got a common issue. Can't we maybe look at establishing a common work group? I think it's a very positive development. And I think that we definitely want to the degree we can encourage more of that coordination across work groups. As staff behind the scenes, we attempt to stay coordinated to make sure that groups aren't working across purposes, but to the extent to which the actual work groups are really working together on a common purpose, I think is a very positive development. So I conclude by thanking everybody, and I'm very happy to be here today.
Any questions for Jason? Yes.
You saw the second list of new people to the MRT.
Dave, just can you introduce yourself just for
sure.
People who are
David McNally
with
AARP. We saw the second list of newly added people to the MRT. Will there be any additional ads? Because honestly, we were concerned that there weren't enough consumers on the first set that came out. We expressed that. The second set of names are now out, and frankly, we still have that concern that there aren't enough consumer representatives on the actual MRT.
Understood. It's been a challenge. We have a team of what is now 32 members to be with the state as diverse as this one to try to represent all of the particular interests. There were a number of concerns that we heard through the process in terms of places that we've left off. Consumers was one. We also had concerns about diversity, which we attempted to address. We did add a consumer representative to the committee in Harvey Rosenthal, who not only as a consumer but also as an advocate, and then also I think I would say as important is also as a behavioral health expert, given the focus on behavioral health. That said, we also heard a lot of complaints from the North Country that said that we weren't representative enough of the North Country, and so Chandler Ralph brings that perspective from the Adirondacks. But understand full well, at this point, we aren't anticipating any additional appointments. That said, you know, obviously things can change, and people could decide to leave the MRT at this point. The problem is that if we get any bigger than we already are, having tried to help manage the discussion when you had 27 people, all of whom have strong opinions and lots to say, it's hard to manage and allow everyone to have an active opportunity to be actively involved in the discussion. So I think we're really stretching the bounds of a team that's 32 in length.
I would just argue, though, that the largest group of people that are going to be affected by everything the MRT does, it's not president, CEO, institutions, organizations that provide the services, it's the consumers. And there doesn't seem to be a very good proportion of consumers represented on the MRT.
Understood. You know, our hope is that, you know, what we've strived to do with work groups was a hybrid approach to trying to get more participation in the process. As I said, not just on the consumer side, but more generally. I think, you know, when we roll out the full 10 groups, there's going to be somewhere in the range of 125 people who are going to be participating on the 10 work groups. Our hope is that that collective force of interest coming together around complex topics like long-term care reform and move to mandatory managed long-term care will provide a very deep perspective, you know, broad range of opinions coming together around a topic. And that as a result of your ability to hopefully achieve consensus and make compromise will lead to recommendations that, you know, the MRT will endorse, and that whatever shortfalls we have in terms of membership will be made up for by the fact that so many voices will, at the end of the day, play a role in developing the final recommendation. But, you know, I think at the end of the day, it's really up to everyone will have their perspective on whether the final product is truly representative of the collective.
Could I just,
Melody.
Melanie Shaw from the New York Association on Independent Living, and I would strongly support what David had said, and really the underlying issue was at the start, considering the community of people with disabilities and older adults who have disabilities and the advocates who represent them. There are many people like Harvey who are both consumers and advocates and specialists in service provision. But I would also say that as you go along around to the groups, if you could encourage each work group as well as the MRT to take the perspective that David just talked about, the people that are being served are the primary stakeholders, constituents. Everything we do must be directed to what are their needs and what is the state's responsibility in terms of serving them under state and federal law.
All right. Let me just make sure that we also introduce Courtney Burke. We don't have a formal kind of sign for you, Courtney. Please just introduce yourself and welcome.
Sure. Courtney Burke, the Commissioner for the Office for People with Developmental Disabilities, and very interested in what's been going on and wish that I had the time initially to get involved sooner, so I'm glad to be here now.
Okay. And let me also welcome Doug Goggins Callahan from the Medicare Rights Center, one of the members of our work group as well. So we're now going to get underway, and I just want to make sure that we understand we are trying to create the future here. And we are going to ask you to embrace these guiding principles. These have to be the principles of the work group. So as that is a prelude, we have 12 principles, and we're going to start with taking a look at principle number one.
Carol, could you just comment first on how the principles were developed?
Okay. Mark in Valencia, you want to talk about that?
Sure.
Good question. Did everyone hear?
No.
Kathy, can you just say
Yeah, I just asked her to comment on how the principles were developed initially.
Thanks, Kathy. This is Mark Kissinger, and I'll comment a little bit. We had an internal staff, not really a work group, but a group of people at the staff level that worked on the principles in conjunction with the governor's office, and tried to really set up principles that were based in the statute that was enacted, and also kind of where the MRT is going forward. So a lot of the principles are, you know, broader than necessarily we'd like, but with principles you kind of set the broad and then we get to specific on the guidelines. So it's really staff work of the health department and with working in conjunction with the governor's office.
Okay, Mark, do you just want to say one more word about the statute that you were referring to?
Sure. In the budget this year, there was a lot of things that happened, and one of the things that got enacted was this mandate for persons who need a home and community-based long-term care services to get those services through a managed long-term care plan or a care coordination model. As defined by guidelines developed by the commissioner, which could include the long-term home health care program. So there's a lot of discussion with the legislature about this mandate, and the language is actually pretty sparse, but there's not a ton of detail, but that was the language upon which we're building these principles, and then ultimately the guidelines will be released by November 15th that further articulates the legislative.
Joanne.
Joanne Constantino, just maybe a process question. As I read the principles yesterday, when we received them, there is some overlap, I think, or some connectivity to the principles, because if you accept one, it almost potentially leads you to another one. So just for a process point of view, Carol, are you hoping that we can make it through all the principles?
Yes.
Are you looking to debate each one of them?
Well, all of the above. I mean, my goal is that we're going to get through all 12 today because there is connective tissue and they do relate together. So we need to get through all. And in order to do that, I may have to be somewhat ruthless in cutting off discussion on principle so we can move along, but we can always backtrack.
They are fluid. The idea is that they're presented, they'll be discussed. If we need to make changes, we'll make changes. They're not written so that there is no change that could be put forth relating to them. So they're guiding principles just that.
I very much support what Eli said. And that also holds for anything we're missing that you think needs to be a guiding principle that we have not captured. Okay, so we're going to start with principle number one, and that's the care coordination model, also known as the CCM, must provide or contract for all Medicaid long-term care services in the benefits package. And that means that the service package includes both community-based and institutional Medicaid-covered long-term care services. The CCM is responsible for assessing the need for, arranging, and paying for all Medicaid long-term care services.
Could you begin,
Alan.
Could you define the package that constitutes long-term care services? For example, the MLTCs now cover an array of services that some people do not consider long-term care, for example, vision, dietary, dental, DME, et cetera, et cetera. Is the intent to have the CCM cover the same bundle of services or a broader one or a narrower one?
Okay. More.
That's the question. I mean, we talked about it. I guess what's the intent of the group? When we talked about, obviously, vision and dental are not termed long-term care services, but that's an open question for the group. Right? We don't have a predetermined opinion. We have some opinions, but we don't have a predetermined decision on that.
I would say,
what do you think?
What do I think?
Yeah.
I think that if I don't work for the state, I never have.
We don't have any jobs over here.
I'm proud of that, dude, right? If the intent overall is to find a way to achieve a way to limit the growth, at the very least, limit the growth of Medicaid services, if not to cap it in some way, then not to include all those other services or range is going to be a big mistake. I think the more services you get into the bundle, the more services you find a way to capitate, the more control at the end of the day you'll get. So I would prefer that the package be as broad and expansive as possible. But at the same time, Joanne, I think, maybe comments about the interrelatedness of some of these. When we get to the item on risk adjustment, that we find some way to consider that, because some of these populations are going to use more of a given service, and that has to be incorporated.
Okay. Joanne.
I wanted to step back a little bit because I am concerned, as I read most of these principles, that it seems that we have a model that is not going to work well in many geographic areas of this state. And I say that for several reasons. One, I think it's an insurance model, not a provider model. And that makes me particularly, as you start talking about what services are covered under, it starts to make me pretty nervous when you talk about differences about the capacity to access and arrange and pay for services in areas that may not be as urban as some other areas are. The other thing, so it's really kind of a question of inclusive. I am very nervous that this is designed, and I see it in that connectivity. This is an insurance model and not a provider model. And one of the things that we hear a lot about is for these programs to work financially, you need significant enough volume if it is a payer source that I don't think is realistic in many parts of this state. I've heard numbers of 5,000 for MLTCs, maybe 2,500 if you're really good at your job. The density question to me is a critical threshold question about whether or not you can have one model or not. So just on the first principle alone, the concept that a CCM needs to assess, which I, you know, could be helpful in participating in assessing, but actually doing the full assessment about whether somebody needs dental care or whatever, I think is a stretch. Arranging, I think, is a stretch because most of people have relationships with physicians, and now you're adding, asking care coordination entity to somehow assume that role, and we know that's not always easy to do. The one that really threw me a little bit is the concept of payer, because to me that moves you directly into an insurance model, not a service model. So I will just lay out, because I read most of these, I really thought we didn't have the first meeting of this group, because I think in that first group we talked about the need for differentiation based on geography, the consumers that we're trying to serve, and I didn't see that. I saw a one-shop, one-approach model. So you will just hear that from me a lot today.
Joanne, what is your thought on the entity being responsible for the whole spectrum of long-term care services? Put aside the dental and the vision, but let's include the home and community-based services and the nursing home or institutional services. To me, that is a fundamental question in a long-term care system.
So, and I'll put on my bias hat because I have biases. I haven't been in this business for this long without developing biases along the way, and people can certainly debate with me their view of it. When I think about home and community-based services, and I think about what we do within the Eddy system, and the 600 or 700 people that we serve every day in long-term home health care programs, for example, my view, my job, and our job as staff is to be sure that keeping that person in the community has to be a coordinated approach. And working with that person, that family, that person's rep to get the right services, but working with other providers that that person may have a relationship with. However, to suggest that a long-term home health care program then becomes ultimately responsible for placement in a skilled nursing facility, to me, is a questionable capacity issue for them to accomplish. So I think you have to be really, I mean, I understand this is a brave new world, and I'm ready to go there, maybe kicking and screaming a little bit, but I think you have to be realistic about what can be the reasonable expectations for different organizations.
Okay. All right, let Joanne finish.
And then if you flip it, if you've got somebody in a nursing home that necessarily wants to go back out in the community, to suggest that nursing home then becomes the entity responsible for assessing, arranging, and paying for from community services. I think you have to recognize operational realities and the skill set of entities and not to try to solve all the problems in the world. I'm a supporter of care coordination. Have it within the expertise of the entity that is, you're asking for those responsibilities.
Okay, Marilyn.
I want to echo that and add that I'd be probably extremely nervous about when it talks about, you know, care coordination in community and nursing home. I have been in rooms where most of the plans is that anyone who gets more than 12 hours care is unsafe in the community and should be in a nursing home. And everything I've read, I see no oversight or no entity, the state or whatever, looking into that to see that the institutional bias is not continued.
Okay, Betty.
I want to echo Joanne's comment. You know, one of the principles of managed care is critical mass and avoiding of adverse selection. So you need to have a balance of both sides of the stream. And if you have a population of 300, as the one and only managed care plan in my county has, there's, you know, that's a very intense pace model. But it does not lend itself as far as everybody being able to enroll up to 5,000 people to be able to manage that whole risk. I challenge the ability of any small population to be able to do that, other than if you had just a specific a PACE program. And the PACE program in Monroe County has not been able to grow. We have 285 enrollees. So there's a real challenge to how you would operationalize the whole approach.
Okay. Kathy?
I think we need to make sure that we distinguish between care coordination and what's in the benefit package. Because I think we're talking here really first partly about what's in the long-term care package, but also care coordination. And if we are going to evolve the managed long-term care program into a health home under the federal statute, they have to be responsible for care coordination for all of the services.
I mean, I think the one thing challenge this group has is that inherently the state legislature, the governor, sort of made a decision to move to mandatory managed long-term care. So then the question really becomes for this group is how the state does that. And I think one of the questions is that if nursing home benefit is not part of the managed long-term care benefit package, then where is it? Is it in standalone fee-for-service, which I think creates a problematic incentive, and potentially also leaves people sitting in fee-for-service nursing homes who might very well like to be back in the community, but no real infrastructure to assist them to move out. And I think one of the hopes, and I think if you look across the country, other states, is that plans, if, you know, properly structured, properly incentivized, have potentially better capacity to move people out of nursing homes when they and their families want it to happen than if a person is just sitting in fee-for-service nursing homes.
Okay. But there is a capacity and there is a model that is currently both transitioning and diverting people from nursing facilities, and that's the nursing facility transition and diversion waiver.
Which has not been very effective.
Has not been very effective, and we would argue because of bureaucratic barriers that have been put up in the Department of Health. And we've made that very clear to Mark and the governor's office over a long period of time. That notwithstanding, it's still a model that works. And a model that is based on the whole point of people being in the community, that community first is the goal of the system. So the question is two things. How is that model, which has been also very successful with the TBI waiver, same model, same types of folks, different kinds of conditions. But also as providers of the plan look to providing both care coordination and services, how are they going to use other very knowledgeable providers in the community, for example, independent living centers who have been transitioning and diverting people from facilities for 20-odd years. It's a very basic activity that they provide. Those organizations are out there, and if there's a capacity issue with respect to traditional providers, both ILCs and other organizations are available. How do they work into our picture?
And I think that question is a fundamental and very positive question to discuss. discuss, because basically what Kathy said, there's a whole discussion going on around health homes. Long-term care is really sort of phase two of health homes. But one of the questions is that there's a myriad of providers on the acute care side, people doing tardy case management, a lot of things, you know, supportive housing, lots of positive things, usually in small scale. So how do we ensure we don't lose those providers, but at the same time build in a much more coordinated system? And I think one of the things we've challenged with on the health home side is making sure we have network requirements that are more inclusive, more specific, to try to expand upon the current set of providers to make sure that there are sufficient patient protections. You know, I think those are all things that as we move to mandatory managed long-term care, that, you know, are the kind of things that, you know, we would want specific recommendations.
Okay. Let's see, comments on this slide. Okay. Joe.
Joe Healy. Two comments. One to follow up on Joanne's initial comments. I just have my own biases. I just read this as a payer model, and perhaps it's because of where I come from, both now and my career history in healthcare, because my organization is both a provider and a payer, and so I see those things as integrated, and in fact, I strongly suspect, I don't know for certain, that the vast majority, maybe even all of the managed long-term care organizations in New York State had their origin as provider organizations, and are, I think, the DNA of the organization is provider DNA, not insurance DNA. I actually think it's very important to as we move forward, to keep that alignment. The responsibility for caring for someone and the responsibility of being sort of steward of the financial resources, I think, is part of what Medicaid reform is about. And so I think keeping that provider perspective, I think, really needs to be at the heart of what this is about. And that ties to the consumer perspective as well. That said, I think we need a higher, these principles come from a higher set of objectives. And so I think maybe it's worth talking a little bit about what those are. What were the objectives of Medicaid reform? Why are we where we are today? And then these principles, whatever they turn out to be ultimately, need to be aligned with and supporting those higher level objectives. These weren't just sort of developed out of whole cloth. That should help us frame the discussion. I think that's partly where Jason was going, I think.
Okay. I think that's worth stepping back and thinking about the objectives and the decisions that have already been made, because I do agree the decision has been made that we're moving toward managed long-term care, and this work we've been charged with determining how we're going to do that. So, Jason, you want to tackle?
Sure, I think that's exactly right, and I think that's what we should take this into account. I mean, basically the direction is over the next 3 years, the state of New York is going to get out of the fee-for-service system. So the real question before us is how we do that. And that's the policy direction. I know that not everybody supported that direction, but I think that, and you know, you're not the only group to grapple with that. I mean, it was a very contentious debate. There was a very contentious debate in behavioral health. And that group, in essence, is, you know, had to sort of set aside the battles of the past to sort of think about, okay, so we're moving in this direction towards better coordination on behavioral health side with the acute care side. How do we make that work? How do we protect what's strong about the current system? But also understand that we're moving to a new environment and that the status quo, this is not going to continue. And so the question is how we collectively define the future. And I think, you know, that's really the challenge you have before us. My fear would be that if all that happens today is we sort of re-debate the subject of whether we should go to mandatory managed long-term care, then we don't necessarily accomplish much, because what we need to do is we want your work, your advice, to advise the state in terms of how we move forward with implementing this program. And my fear is that if you don't, I'm not saying it's going to be complete consensus. Not every group is going to reach consensus. But to the degree we can, we want your perspective in terms of what kinds of protections. And I personally think much of the concern that people have and some of the things I've heard in terms of is there a sufficient upstate capacity. That's a major question. We won't be able to move to mandatory managed long-term care. We won't be able to contract with entities until there are entities that exist who meet the state standards. And I think that, well, we have an opportunity, this group does, to advise us on what those standards should be. And so, you know, we hope to get there in 3 years, but if we can't get there because we can't find in certain counties, and there are certain counties on for low-income family size that haven't gone completely mandatory yet because there aren't sufficient providers there. So I think in a diverse state like New York, we're going to be challenged in some parts of the state, but we also have, you know, the vast majority of our population still living in urbanized centers where we do think we either have capacity now or we will have capacity in the near future. So.
I have to say that the issues that have been raised about how to operationalize this, the upstate capacity, Maryland's issue about concern about stinting, I mean, those are all issues, you know, we have to tackle. But from my point of view, it's hard to think about a long-term care system in which you don't have the whole spectrum of long-term care services. And we have some of the parts of the system are more robust than others. But I think we talk about helping people to be in the least restrictive setting. And sometimes people can go into a nursing home even for a short stay because it's a place for some rehabilitative services and they're going to come back out. So it's just hard for me to conceptualize an integrated system in which from the outset we begin to split off parts of the long-term care service continuity, at least as I think about it. But let's hear from other people. Dave.
I'd like to go back to Joanna Joe's comment. And it's not really about splintering off the various services required to have a long-term care care and choices. It's more basic than that even. The CCM is the vision they will do the assessment. The same organization will be doing the assessment and providing the services.
Yes.
It just seems like there should be some sort of third rail or a firewall sometimes. It just seems odd that those who are making the assessment are also the ones that are going to be deciding how much money they're going to get and how much services that person needs. It seems odd to me that they wouldn't be having a third-party assessment going on. I mean, if I'm providing services and I'm also doing an assessment, it seems like I would be assessing that person to get as much of my services as I could.
It's not an
open payment system where I come into the state and I say, these are all the needs, give me the money to pay for it.
Let's
talk about risk adjustment.
Yeah.
I guess maybe I'm ahead of myself a little bit.
Yeah.
Okay, maybe someone could just spend a minute just explaining to Dave how it works today in Valencia, right?
I mean, right now, the Spanish long-term care programs, I mean, you look at the utilization and establishing the premium for the individual. So you're looking at the acuity of the population,
right,
and you're trying to adjust the, align the incentive in plan when you provide a capitated rate. Also, in all of the plans that exist now, the balance of that is that they're always due process rights. So that if a person believes that they are not getting the services that they are needed, there are opportunities for that to be appealed. In every managed care plan that exists, people do exercise those rights in appealing within plan, appealing external to the plan, and also appealing to the Department of Health.
But the capitation rate will be based on the risk assessment of the person, so there will be different capitations.
No, it's not the person, it's for the individual population.
Well, right, but I mean, there will be different capitated rates.
But when the rate is developed, it takes into consideration the utilization patterns of the current population that's about to enroll.
But none of the tools have really reflected that.
All right.
That's the question.
Right. The sort of adequacy of the premium is a separate issue. But
I think Dave's underlying point is this is.
This is Michael.
I think Dave's underlying point is a compelling one, and I'll frame it as a question. And whether you're doing rates for individuals or for groups, the underlying point is the same. Is the assessor financially incentivized to calculate or estimate a higher level of prison?
Well,
Right.
I mean, it's the basic.
Okay.
Well,
either
way. Basic tenet.
Okay.
Lower. I
mean, let Mark jump in here.
This is Mark Lane. I think the fundamental opportunity we got here is going from a fee-for-service model to a managed care. That's the fundamental issue. And the fundamental issue is that under a fee-for-service model, you got what the provider was going to provide. There was no questions asked. You just provided it, i.e., home care now. We've had for years people with 24-hour personal aid services. Now there's a potential audit going on with CMS, the Department of Health. The home care agencies are saying, well, wait a minute, maybe we need to move these people out. And then all of a sudden, from all the advocacy groups and the consumerism, you know, now this bad managed long-term care plan has now got that referral. And that referral does not say that that person is safe to be in that environment. Well, for 6 months down the road, you're going to have that person in that place. The fundamental issue we've got is that this is all this redesign is somewhat quality, but also controlling cost. The state can no longer afford the types of Medicaid dollars it has been expending. And the bottom line is we're going to have to be more efficient and put the quality indicators and all the protections. But the bottom line is it's going to be managed, where heretofore it hasn't been.
Okay. Mark Kissinger, did you want to say something on this?
No, I think.
Okay. Let's see if there's anyone who wants to speak who hasn't spoken yet. Mary.
And just as a representative, of one of those home care programs that does have 24-hour patients in it, I think we have a basic truth here that we have to acknowledge as part of the work we do is that, which is no matter how well we manage, there are individuals that you are going to be enrolling in managed long-term care or any care coordination model that have needs that may take 24 hours, that may require 24 hours care. The predisposition and the right to receive that care in the home, in a community setting, and the management of that care is not going to change that the underlying medical need or the constellation of needs that that individual exhibits. So I agree that we, in operating a personal care program that is a fee-for-service program in New York City, that we, you know, didn't concern ourselves too much with the other medical services that the person was receiving. And, in fact, other than receiving initial or periodic assessments or orders from the physician, we didn't regularly consult with the physicians. But we did basically reassess the case, and there is some portion of our universe that any degree of management is not really going to change a basic fact that we have to accept here.
Okay. So that's an important cautionary note. It can change the structure, but that may not change the need. Right. So, all right.
Thanks, Carol. Doug Ogdellian from Medicare Aid. I wanted to just quickly echo what Mary said. I think that's very true. I also think some of that harkens back to what Joanne raised earlier in terms of who's at the center of providing the management of care. And I think, you know, at least from the Medicare perspective, you know, the management is seen as, you know, solely provided by the insurance company. And I think in some ways that was sort of it's an ongoing experiment in the Medicare world, but in some ways sort of a failed one in the sense that the Affordable Care Act sort of recognized that at least the way they had been designing the payments to plans, you know, that basically fee-for-service was actually more cost-effective than managed care. So I think the group going forward, that's sort of an important thing to recognize, sort of one, who's at the center of the care? Is it the, you know, the management is the consumer? Is it the provider? Or is it the insurance company? And also, you know, in structuring, as David was saying, the payment, you know, are we really achieving cost efficiency simply by putting people from fee-for-service?
I think, Doug, you're referring to sort of the MedPAC work that
That's
shows
right.
that Medicare Advantage plans actually ended up
getting paid 13% more than
exactly
the
right.
service.
But that was an intentional policy decision. I mean, that wasn't...
it was a, but none
yeah.
of that. Okay. We
the intention to pay more.
Right. All right. So we're going to take two more comments, and then we're moving on to what I think will even be a more compulsory. Number two. Okay, Kate, you haven't spoken yet.
I mean, this has been a very robust discussion, but I really don't think we even hit the terms of principle one is what are those long-term care services defined, going back to what Ellen has said. Are we going to include dental? Are we going to include those other key pieces? Or are we, you know, what is the long-term care services? I agree that the institutional, I know not everyone does, the institutional piece is an important piece to have that care coordination because it is the incentive to keep people out of the nursing home. Or to work with them because there are times where the institutional care is necessary or a better measure in certain parts of the state or a better way to keep someone safe. So I think it's important, but really, is it our role here to define what that care package, that package is?
Okay. Do you think it is?
I think what it is the, I think the big question here on one for me is to the extent to which does managed long-term care include both the acute care services, which it does today, which I would argue, particularly when we think about the duals population, who consume 36% of the Medicaid spend goes to fund the long-term care services to dual eligibles. It consumes 48% of the total Medicare expenditure in the state of New York goes to dual eligibles, yet there's very little coordination between those two payers. And if we're actually going to get to a more coordinated model that actually looks at that whole person, you're going to have to bring together the acute care world and the long-term care world are going to have to come together. So I would argue that I think it makes sense that those services, to the extent that, you know, and I think the members benefit from the fact that they can, in one stop shop, get access to more than just the basic long-term care services. The other big question is on the long-term care, I mean, on the long-term care side of the institutional piece. And I personally think that having an army of plans out there incentivized to try to work with current nursing home recipients to help them move out as opposed to relying on the bureaucratic state system, which, you know, is entirely underfunded. My organization has a 42% vacancy rate, and I don't think that's going to change anytime soon. And so the question is that our plans better positioned, especially if financially incentivized, to work with those patients to move them out? Other states are far more successful in moving people. We do a pretty good job of keeping people out of the nursing home in the first place, but in terms of those people who are there, moving them back out, we lag behind other states. And I think to the extent to which we include the long-term care benefit in the long-term benefit, the nursing home piece, I think we better align the incentives to encourage more home-based care.
Okay, Courtney, did you want to say something?
I think it'd be interesting.
One really important thing, and especially for people with physical disabilities, but large, if not the majority of the population, are not able to get eligible. So, as we
move on. Right. You made that point at the first meeting
And the other point is, you said there was the incentive. What incentive Jason, are you talking about?
Well, right now, if I'm in a fee for service nursing home, there really is no one out there to, who has a financial incentive to help. If my family want to look at home-based care options, there's no one who really has a financial incentive out there in the system. We got a waiver program that's designed to help, hasn't been real effective. Maybe there's some other community-based organizations who may be out there to help, but there's no sort of systemic effort out there to help those people identify what their home options are. My past experience suggests that it's a hard work to move somebody out of a nursing home.
You know, we've had a waiver in here that hasn't worked.
Right. We just talked about that. And
how do you make it work?
Okay, we're moving on to principle number two. CCMs must be financially at risk for the services in the benefit package. The CCM will receive a periodic payment to cover the services in the benefit package to promote the appropriate and efficient use of services for which it is responsible. Okay. All right, Joanne.
Okay. For the record, I believe in care coordination. So if anyone is suggesting that my statements were suggesting that I want to re-debate the issue of fee-for-service versus care coordination, that's a misunderstanding of what I was trying to say. What I'm trying to say is I think you can't just have one model that fits every circumstance that we were going to face with consumers who, as Wendy was saying, are the ultimate. So as you look at number two, the question becomes, and I don't know if you can really define number two, if you deal with the benefit issue, because I may or may not be able to take more risk depending on what's included in the benefit. But if there are things in the benefit package that I don't have control over, then I think it is going to create a lot of disincentive for entities to become a CCM. You're going to have them become CCM, and they're going to go belly up really quickly. So I think people are willing to take risk for things that they believe they have elements of control over. So I think it almost goes back to that first question on the benefit piece. For example, HCA and the other associations have come up with a proposal to move the long-term home health care program to a per-episode capitation model. I think what they're saying is we're willing to take some risk for the services that we have control over. But how can you ask us to take risk for services that we can't totally influence? Home care agency, a CCM, doesn't always decide who goes to the hospital. They don't always decide what specialist. I want to ground us in the real world out there, moving us forward to a care coordination model for recognizing its model, I think, of care coordination, not one.
I don't think anybody's suggesting in two that a person would be held accountable for benefits for which they do not have influence. I don't think that's ever in the intent. I mean, I think inconsistent with managed care in general is that you have a benefit to manage, you have received a capitation payment, you're at risk for that benefit. So if the nursing home benefit is in it, then you're responsible for managing it. If it's not, you're not responsible. So you don't receive the payment, and you're not at risk. So I think your primary concern, if I heard it correctly, I think it certainly is not the intent, is to put someone at risk for a benefit for which they do not receive a direct payment and have control.
But the first principle says that it includes
institutional
as well as community.
Correct.
Right, but not
hospital.
Right. Well, number one of them does. Care managing primary and acute care.
Well, that's number four. Okay, we'll come to that one. All right. Any other comments on principle number two? Tom, what do you think?
Well, I'm just interested. Have we identified by county, by region, eligibles, people that we think are going to be the participants in these plans?
Mm-hmm.
Can you share those numbers?
Absolutely. I mean, it's basically the fee-for-service long-term care population. And
right. You know, person doesn't need long-term care in 120 days, so it's your personal care population. It's a vast majority of your home health care population and the Medicaid benefit.
Do the vast majority of the upstate counties have a minimum of 5,000 enrollees to support that?
What? Where do you come up with the number 5,000?
5,000 is a principle around how you manage care.
Magic about 5,000, I'll tell you that.
Right. Well, I think 4,000 and 5,000 is what actuaries have said, that
right,
in order
right.
for it to be sustainable in the insurance market, they need
right.
that max. However, these models are being configured a little different. They're community-based providers. We acknowledge that there are many paid and medical
much smaller
who have not reached that max and are operational and continuing to function in managed care.
But that is directly related to their benefit package. Once you go beyond, a larger benefit package, you have to have that max because the risk isn't predictable otherwise.
Okay.
Joe, can you speak a little louder?
I think only three of the existing managed long-term care organizations in the state are over 5,000 members. The majority of them are.
But I think the question about is upstate counties, is there going to be sufficient capacity, does exist. And that's a real question. But I think the intent what's logical is that we couldn't implement mandatory managed long-term care unless there are sufficient entities to provide the service.
Jason, on that.
Oh, wait a second, Marilyn. Hang on. Marilyn,
I think it's important, though, to make clear that there is no threshold below which it doesn't work. Nationally, the PACE programs are historically much smaller than the MLPC in New York. New York in the MLPC program has higher enrollment in the state than PACE does nationally. And yet, across the country, where there is full cap on PACE, and they're small, they're doing fine. If they weren't doing fine, they'd go out of business, and I don't see them going out of business. So I think the idea that you have to have a magic number, 5,000, 4,000, 10,000, to be viable, I think it's just that. It's a magic number that's illusory.
Well, I would just say that it depends on the model. PACE is a very closed model, and it's much easier to manage the risk when you have a very closed model.
It's not as closed as you might think. I mean, because those programs have comprehensive benefits. Most PACE programs do not employ specialists. Most PACE programs do not own or operate a hospital. They don't own nursing homes. So they're contracted with specialists, with hospitals, with nursing homes, with Medicare agencies. They are contracting for and coordinating a lot of benefits that are not provided by people they employ. So it's a more open model than you think, and as these programs scale, and they are being challenged to scale, they will become even more so.
And just to give we are already, just for folks to be aware, we're receiving new applications. Every day there's a new application out on the website for plans to apply. We're receiving quite a few. Based on just the applications today, we could make 13 more upstate counties into mandatory managed long-term care that aren't currently there today, just based on the applications we received. Now, we haven't fully vetted all those applications yet, but I think there's clearly plan interest for moving upstate. So I think that there's certainly, at least they and their actuaries are thinking that there's opportunities for scale.
Okay, Marilyn, you were next.
Enrolling in the fact that the plans, like Joe just said, very few have a lot, have significant numbers above 5,000 or close to 5,000 yet. With the end of fee-for-service, people are going to be forced into, consumers of the service are going to be made to go into a plan. How? And what is going to be done to prepare the plan to take this, intake of large numbers of people? How are they going to be staffed? How are they going to, the relationship, getting the staff, getting the expertise, doing the assessment? How do you do this the way the hospital plans operate now?
Okay, do you want to answer that question, Mark?
Right, I have the wrong time. I guess it's going to be like it is in every other new initiative, and that's going to be a ramp up, and it's going to be based upon the requirements as imposed by the State Department of Health and what they're expecting and the level of due diligence for, quote, approval of a specific county and what you have to do. It's similar to what we're experiencing now with the managed long-term care applications. They're looking at network, they're looking at case management, they're doing full due diligence relative to, do you have the capacity?
Well, what about the plans that are in existence now?
In existence now.
Well, that is a question. You know, I have a number of questions in the parking lot. Actually, Kevin Finnegan raised that at the last meeting, which is how do you monitor and keep your eye on the plans once they're established. So we will come back to that. Mark.
I raised my hand now to answer your question, Marilyn.
Okay.
But a number, I think one and two need to be combined. I think somebody reflected what are the long-term benefits. And rather than saying financially at risk, what you're saying is that the CCMs will be capitated. I got that. But you also need to tie in actuarial soundness and the basis of, I see it on the back, but let's put it together. Let's put the actuarial soundness.
Something like a true health plan to eat.
And let's also reflect what the fee for service has been paying. Pay at that, it cannot happen overnight. So you can't take your 100% of the fee for service spend and say, okay, actuarially, we're going to get Mercer to say we're going to pay at 85%, because that's a collision course and inappropriate with the providers, particularly the consumers, and the plan. And then the state watches. It's wrong. You've got to start with
100%. The principle.
The principle between one and two and the back page is you've got to combine that principle. You don't need all of them. Just one big one relative to capitation, actuarially sound, and based on initially 100% of the Medicaid fee for service spend.
So it's basically one, two, and ten.
Correct. I combine them together because if you're going to underprice in the capitation rate, you're going to have collision course in the environment. Yeah. And it's going to be injurious to the providers, particularly the consumers.
So you're saying that you have to manage the expectations of the state in terms of the savings being achieved up front rather than...
It has to be graduated.
Exactly.
It has to be worked on collaboratively with the providers and the consumers.
Right, which I think we have a precedent there, which is personal care benefit added into mainstream plans. We added in the full expense, understanding it was a new benefit for those plans. Now, prescription drugs is a different story mm-hmm. because that's a more traditional product. More specific, and plans had more experience doing that, so there was an expected discount there. So, I mean, what you're raising is a valid point that we don't, try to, generate hundreds of millions of dollars in savings overnight as a result of managed long-term care.
Okay. All right, let's hear from
Helen.
Sorry. Go ahead.
I guess I have a question about the
Medicare
Part B
discussion.
I would absolutely support it. But then I think back to what Marilyn was saying earlier, if you actually are going to try to incentivize people to plans to take people out of nursing homes, then you actually have to change the current incentives, which right now actually personally incentivize people to go into nursing homes.
Mm-hmm.
So if that's our policy goal with CEO, it should be, then you have to think about how to change the existing incentives, not just exactly mirror the spend. So I would say that, and then just a question, which I think is related to some of the questions about transition. The principles don't really talk about implementation and transition and getting from where we are now to these principles. So I don't know if this needs to be part of the principles or if it's a separate discussion, but, echoing what we said before about community care, et cetera. I just wanted to ask where we're going to talk about that.
So I don't know, Mark, if you want to say anything. The issue around, let's say we define the future state here, and then we're in today's world. How do we get from today's world to the future state? And any thoughts that you have about the working role in tackling some of that?
Sure. I mean, I think obviously you saw with the personal care inclusion August 1, there was a lot of work done with the city, especially Mary and her staff. State and the plans and the consumers, that transition, while dire predictions actually produced somewhat a seamless transition. We worked and there will be a big transition, a big change in how we approach long-term care in this state. So obviously we've been working already, but we're starting look for the work group for ideas for issues that pop up earlier better than later. And obviously, we have to get federal approval, so we have to have CMS involved as well. But we look for any and we'll approach it in the same way, very open, transparent way, looking for ideas. And as long as I'll keep our eye on the ball that this is happening, not keep renegotiating the past. We're making this change, especially in New York City. This change will happen. We have capacity right now. So and then as we go upstate, we're very sensitive to the issues of incentives. But of capacity. But I think the work group can play a very, very integral role. There's a lot of experts around the table here. You've seen changes in the past. You can give us kind of the issues that have come up in the past, and we can keep it going. I mean, I anticipate that the work group will produce a important report, but we'll talk to all of you going forward. So it's a big change, and we're going to need help.
That's right. Jason and I were just talking about this because, in a way, what Mark Lane had said before crossed from principle to transition, because he was saying, keep the 100% fee for service. And Jason and I were just sort of talking about a principle that would put out that a transition should ensure continuity of care or something around that we should try to shape. We're not getting the words quite right.
Well,
yet,
I just wanted to add the statute also. Requires continuity of care for the mentor. So, we shouldn't eliminate that.
Right.
It's already in statute that requires that.
So it would be an easy principle to ask.
Yes. Right, something that captures this. So Michael and Melanie.
On Mark Lane's point, I think that's very interesting. What
what I heard was, I heard two points. I heard a structural point and a technical point. And the structural point was extremely compelling, combining Principle 1 on benefits package, Principle 2 on capitation, and Principle 10 on actuarial soundness. That's, I think, is a fantastic point. The technical point about 100% fee-for-service as the benchmark, I found complicated.
All right, 110.
Here's why. I mean, two points. The first is a very simple point. From a budget analysis standpoint, 100% of prior utilization plus a care management fee equals not only no budget savings, but additional costs.
Mm-hmm. Well, but that's not what you said, is it, Mark?
Well, no, I like where Michael's going.
No, you can also say that.
What I'm saying is actuarial soundness does not necessarily equate to 100% of prior utilization. What we're doing here is we're transitioning from fee-for-service to Medicaid managed care. The underlying principle there is that you're going to increase the effectiveness and the efficiency of utilization. Now, that's not to say there isn't underutilization. We saw when we did the transition starting in 2006 of the SSIs into mainstream managed care, there was some overutilization, some underutilization, some misutilization. But the premise that it's all going to sort of come out in the wash and you're going to be at 100% after the fact, I feel is a question, not a sort of it's a very important matter, and I think it's a question, not a sort of an aside to build into
right.
a principle.
I would say the other thing about the goal of managed long-term care is to stem the growth rate, in particularly fee-for-service, non-institutional long-term care services, even more focused down in New York City, where the growth rate in that area has reached a level where it's not sustainable, and our belief inherently with moving to managed long-term care is that we stem the tide of the growth. So it's not just the incremental savings or, you know, the lowering of the base spend, but it's also slowing the rate of growth. And I think that's part of the theory here. And I think certain benefits lend themselves to, you know, and being a little bit more conservative with new populations, new services, you know, so that you don't make a move so fast to managed care that you make it so that the plans don't have a little bit of time to be successful. But over time, the way rates are, in essence, set, it now allows the state to capture savings when the utilization is more effectively controlled. And so I think having a longer-term time horizon, because that's really what we're thinking, you know, 3 to 5 years, we want the plan to be successful, but at the same time, we don't want to overpay.
Plus, demographically, the state has to prepare itself for the future. I mean, what we have now is unsustainable from a demographic point of view.
Yep.
Okay, Melanie, you were next.
Yep. The whole question of risk and incentives, how to structure the incentives and the risk, particularly to deal with the folks with very high costs and high needs who are most at risk of institutionalization. We have, you know, the issue of the goal of trying to reduce costs over time, but we also have some very precise legal requirements that the state has to serve people not in the least restrictive setting, but in the most integrated setting. So the question becomes for the individual provider with the person with very high needs in front of them, what is the state going to transfer of its responsibility, its legal responsibility, to those providers? What are going to be the incentives to make sure that people are served in the most integrated setting? But the providers are faced with, you know, obviously a very different perspective when there's an individual. Certainly that person has fair hearing rights. There is due process that is the balance, as Valencia mentioned, but the state still has a responsibility, and how is that going to play out as individuals are served, particularly those folks with high needs?
All right, Dave.
I'm going to try my assessment issue again here, because I think it's directly related. I guess my concern is we have fair hearing rights and due process under current but not to the scale we're now talking. And my concern is in the assessment piece is twofold. One is keeping the consumer protections and access to the hearings and to the due process robust. Because right now we're talking about several thousand people. If we're really moving to this entire operation in managed care, we're talking about that tenfold. And I'm concerned about is the structure that's in place that fits, that you say fits now for those in those systems, adequate enough to address the wholesale population going into the system? And that's a big question I have. And toward that same end, how do we make sure that if you get a capitated rate and we're trying to achieve savings after 3 to 5 years, when the screw starts turning on the assessment of the person that was in there, and I mean, we see this at the federal level when they cut rates, how do we guarantee that that person isn't going to stop getting what they really need because the plan needs to achieve the savings they got for the capitated rate? What are the safeguards in place?
All right, well, that whole issue of how to deal with protections for consumers, and I think we're going to put under a fair hearing appeals umbrella and really tackle it in a subcommittee.
There is a work group that we're going to try and set up probably the last week of August that will bring together some of the members of this committee, subcommittee, as well as some external people who have an interest in it. To look at the fair hearing issue, the question is the question is not maximizing services, the question is matching clinical needs with what the individual requires to get their care and do it in a fair and effective manner. We'll have that discussion. We'll have a meeting, and we'll have that discussion prior to time that we come back for our next meeting.
Okay, I'm going on to principle number 3, which is a CCM must include a care management function that is targeted to the needs of the enrolled population. Every individual must have a care manager or care management team that's responsible for assessments and reassessments, care plan development and implementation, care plan monitoring, service adjustment, and problem solving. The care management function should address the varying needs of the population and should encompass high touch, low touch, as dictated by the needs of the member and informal support and caregiver. Are there any comments on this? Okay, Melanie.
I would add, as dictated to the needs of the member, not so much dictated by the member, but certainly controlled by the member. The process has to be a person-centered process and a person-directed process, because the individual knows what their needs are better than anyone else. And I would also say that the individual has to have the opportunity to direct their own care. So person-directed and person-centered. And some individuals have the capacity to direct their own care, many, and serve as the care manager. And we have to look at the question of whether, for example, the consumer-directed program is one of those other models that the statute refers to with respect to managed long-term care and other models. There's the care coordination model. And I would put the NHTT waiver in that same category. How can we use those existing models in this structure moving forward that have been successful and that put the individual at the center of services?
Okay, Marilyn?
I want to echo everything that Melanie's saying and just bring in the practical world where I work and what we do. This is our guiding principles of consumer leading your team and everyone working around establishing those helping to provide the services. And there are those huge groups of people who can do that and do not need intensive care management. All they need to do is be able to articulate what they need and with the plan, negotiate whatever, and that should be a basis for a care management model for a segment of the population that's self-directed. And if you have a whole spectrum on the other end, you may have people coming into your plan, and I talked about before, physical disabilities who are brand new with an injury or an illness who don't know about the service state. They don't know about, gee, I can get a wheelchair here, or gee, is that something I should use instead, or whatever, so that any plan that works with any population has to really look at the consumer's ability and willingness to participate in directing their care and take some responsibility. And do it like that, and the plans are going to be allowing, you know, are going to be encouraged to consume direction. And yet, there's no standard as some of the plans and some of the other consumer directed programs in the state are part of my English, a bastardized version of what consumer direction is. It's a semi-medical model, and it's a consumer directed program in name only. And it's, I think there has to be some protection in that. Yeah.
So the way to provide that protection is by contract. I mean, that's really the tool the state, first and foremost tool the state has within the managed care environment is to actually put in specific plan requirements. Now, some of those plan requirements come with cost, but we believe firmly and agree with you that we need consumer protection. So I think the extent to which, as committee members, you have thoughts about specific protections we should put in, the guiding principles, I think, are an opportunity to basically provide clear direction to staff as we're working on those contract details, what specific kind of protections we have. And then the next part of that is then the state is under the obligation to enforce the terms
right.
of those contracts.
And that's what I'm saying. And just to finish on this, we're all kind of learning by the seat of our pants. August 1st, the beginning of, the plans doing personal care. And it's chaotic. Because no one knows what the answers are or how to do it. It's not only chaotic for the plan, it's or the regular Medicaid management care program, not the long-term care program. Not only to the consumer, but to the provider. The way this system is structured now, people coming into the plans are not going to and long-term care programs are not going to be reimbursed at the same level that fee-for-service stuff. And because they are not, it's going to be disruptive from the workers' point of view and just the consumer point of view. And as we're transitioning people into mainframe managed care plans and long-term managed care plans, you can expect people to come willingly, into the consumers to come willingly if they know my A is going to be paid less because the reimbursement is
not
sure.
That's not true.
The personal care has not been, Marilyn, it's been chaotic in the process, and it has not been an easy process for either the department and or plan. But August 1st came and went, and the level of service that was occurring on July 31st is occurring on August 1st and will continue. That's a transition, and that there will be a reassessment done after, I think it's 90 days or whatever, but that's 60 days. But that will be in collaboration with the person, first and foremost, and the provider of the care. But the rates haven't been cut to the personal care worker or the home care.
I'm just saying that nothing will happen in 90 days. What I'm trying to get at is
you're getting worried. I think there may be opportunities. But I don't think it's going to be as bad as what you're sounding to be.
Change, and there is a whole lot of change going on in New York Medicaid program.
Right. And I really don't like the Department of Health, so I'm not speaking in particular, but it has.
Okay. Is there any other comments on number 3? If not, we're going on to where I know there are going to be comments. On number 4, a CCM must be involved in care management of other services for which it is not at risk. And the thinking here is that we're trying to transition to fully integrated models of care, which eventually will include all Medicare and Medicaid services. That's the goal in New York State over the next approximately 3 years. As an interim approach, the CCM must be responsible for care managing primary and acute care services and other services not in the CCM service package to promote continuity of care. So I know this is something Joanne referred to earlier, and also Jason talked about the extraordinary percentage of expenditures attributable to the dual and the fact that they use all parts of the system, the long-term care part, the primary care system, as well as the acute care system. So I'd like to hear reactions to this principle.
A question of language clarification before substantive point Winsor made. The principle itself uses the phrase involved in, but then the sort of text of the paragraph uses the phrase responsible for.
Yeah.
I was a little confused by any intended or unintended
right.
difference.
I think it is a good question, because you start at a lower level of anxiety, and then anxiety. So,
you were just trying to break it to people.
What did you intend, Valencia and Mark?
I think in looking at this principle, the thought was that some, like a long-term home health care program, maybe provide home care, personal care, but they may be responsible for nursing home care and the other elements of long-term care services. And it started in the discussion earlier in trying to define the core benefit package, whether it should include just long-term care or long-term care and the ancillary services are currently included in the managed long-term care benefit package. So that's what we were trying to get at, that it's not only the services that you directly provide, but there may be some additional services that you
can provide. Okay. But the phrase responsible for is not used in conjunction with long-term care services.
Correct.
It's used in conjunction with
primary hospitalization is not something that you would be fiscally responsible for. However, you would coordinate with those providers.
I think I think we need to reword it, because here's part of the thing is that we want to get to full integration, particularly for the dual eligibles. We think that fundamentally, at the end of the day, New York Medicaid program is going to be sustainable, and there was a point mentioned earlier about rate cuts in Medicare. Well, we had a major federal budget deficit. I mean, it's reality check, major fundamental federal budget deficit that's not going away anytime soon. While we have somewhat staved off Medicaid cuts, there's now this committee of Congress people who are meeting potentially major cuts to providers on the Medicare side and potentially further cuts on the Medicaid side. But I think one of the challenges, basically what the MRT's fundamental bet in terms of reform, was if we did a better job of managing care, managing the transitions of care, keeping people healthier through better care coordination, care management, that we could make the program sustainable in the long run. The fiscal realities that the nation faces are what they are, and we can try to ignore them. We should fight off cuts if we can, but I think we have to accept the fact that there's a likelihood, a strong likelihood, that we're going to have less federal money into this program in the future, and we already are basically at the point where we're sort of tapped out on state resources to a great extent. And so the question is that we have sort of two paths to go down. The path that MRT is trying to say is if we do a better job of care coordination, maybe we can make this program sustainable without having to go down the other path. The other path is ever lower rates to providers, asking providers to do more and more with less. That's the route that California has gone. That's the route that a whole series of states are, where they so poorly pay their providers to provide services. And what we're trying to do is to avoid that. So I think the question is that, it says 3 years. Our transition to all out-of-fee-for-service is 3 years. But to get to full integration, particularly for rules, it's probably going to take us longer. But I think what we're trying to get at here is more as much aspirational as it is to sort of signal to the group that what we really want at the end of the day is partners who are prepared to manage the comprehensive needs of the member. I mean, there was a recent study that looked at dual eligibles in New York and found that if, you know, fully integrated, mandatory managed long-term care for dual eligibles could save billions of dollars, maybe about $1 billion a year for New York. And if that was done as an alternative to lower rates, lower payments to providers, I think, you know, that would be a better path for the state to go down. And that's what I'm saying, is that the challenge all you have is that the current status, the current situation is just not sustainable. So the question is, if we're trying to go to care coordination, how do we do it effectively that, you know, protects the patient, protects the member, protects the providers degree we can, but you know, it's making a smart move, and I think that, you know, we have 3 to 5 years to try to, in essence, get this right.
So, you know, in terms of the language, I would prefer at this point to stay involved in rather than responsible.
Yep.
For. Okay. Joe.
I guess I wasn't focused on the involved in or responsible for so much as the part that comes afterwards, and listening to Jason's comment. Question in my mind is, what are the incremental steps toward that full integration? So let me be a little more concrete. Whether it's responsible for or involved in, is it about continuity of care, which is about communication and coordination and information sharing and managing transition for that patient or client or member. So continuity is one thing. Quality is another thing. Someone lands in the ER, gets admitted, shouldn't have been admitted. Responsibility for that is a different thing. Financial responsibility for the hospital experience is yet another step. So I think as we think about the roadmap to full integration, 3, 4, 5, however many years out, maybe the important piece is that might address it is being clear about what the involved in or responsible in is applied to. Is it the continuity, helping to manage transitions, et cetera? Is it
all of the above
care provided somewhere else?
But I think that the long-term care provider can play a pivotal role in helping to avoid unneeded hospitalizations and rehospitalizations. And, you know, also, we can be the ones in the home who can look at what's really going on and reconcile medications and ensure there's a follow-up appointment and work with the caregivers so they are prepared and understand what needs to happen and be a backup system. And let's face it, every time one of our, you know, clients go into the hospital, they're going to come out in worse shape. There's often delirium. They have had a very disruptive experience. And so I just think we can play a pivotal role and ought to if we're trying to redesign the system here.
I totally agree. I mean, I'm for full integration, but I think I'm just recognizing that, and my organization is actually, we do that. So I'm just recognizing that that's not where the rest of the world is.
Where we're going.
I think that's where we're going.
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah, I just want to go back, first to the first meeting. We really talked a lot about this being a bridge to what you just said, a more integrated model. But I also wanted to go back to my earlier comment about health homes, because my understanding is you filed a plan amendment that basically says our managed long-term care plans are going to be health homes, correct?
Yes, if our federal colleagues agree to that, that's
correct. Okay,
right.
So if they agree to that, then there's no question that they are responsible, not involved
that's
in, but responsible for care coordination.
That is another point of this. That's a very important point, is that, what we're attempting to do, and I said a health home sort of two phases. Phase one really is focused on the acute and behavioral health side of the equation. Phase two is going into long-term care services. In the meantime, what we're attempting to do, in essence, is for the MLTCP, we think that it's a comprehensive care coordination model that already is managing benefits outside of just long-term care services, and we're trying to make the argument that it meets the health home standard. Depending on what the feds say, they may say that the MLTCP, in order to meet that standard, which comes with its 90% federal funding, that we may have to expand and ask the MLTCP to do more. Or the other decision is we just don't pursue the 90% federal funding, and I think until we're ready to do so. And I think it is an opportunity, I see it, to begin getting MLTCPs to start thinking a little bit more broadly in terms of their responsibilities, because I agree that there's billions of dollars spent by us on people who are in and out of hospitals inappropriately. We're ranked 50th in the country in that. And one of the big ways we can do that is folks who are home-based, community-based, long-term care services, keeping those people out of hospitals, or people who are in nursing homes, keeping them out of hospitals. And the problem with our current care management model is that there's no way for us to capture that data. And that's Medicare savings for duals. And if we can find a way to capture that savings, that is going to be hugely powerful in making this program work.
Okay, Alan.
Jason's comment, a couple of viewers. There seems to be a focus on the financial incentives and the gains in the system financially. And 50th in the country, and your comment, Carol, about who can go into the home and what's going on, there's an underlying feeling that what we've been doing is terrific, and what we're changing to is financially advantageous for the state, but really not good for the patient and the member and the individual. That's just wrong. The care in New York, the facts are, the care in New York has not been terrific. It's been uncoordinated. It's been expensive. And the person who's been suffering has been the recipient of the care. They haven't been getting good care. Being 50th in the country, close your mind. We're behind South Dakota. We're behind North Dakota. We're behind countries. States that don't provide good care. We all know Mississippi.
Yep.
We're 50th. We're behind Mississippi. Right? But we're spending quantums more.
We're actually now behind Louisiana, I believe. There are 51, including the District of Columbia. I think if you want to feel better, I think Louisiana is a little bit worse.
Yeah. If you ever move to North Dakota,
I've been to North Dakota, and I'm not moving there, Carol. But I think it's important that if New York is providing, we were number one in the country, and we're talking about dismantling what we have because it will save the state money. That would be a terrible thing, because what we have is the best. What we have is near the worst, and we're trying to find a way to make the system better, not only for the person receiving the care, but for the person paying for the care for the state, and create a system that makes sense. And I think we tend to lose sight of that, of the personal arguments and the personal feelings about it. I think it's really important. Your point, plus Jason's, is really, really important. We're not the best, we're the worst. And we're trying to make it better.
Okay, Kate.
Going back to that health home question, we're also considering right now other care coordination models. Now we're putting the MLCC up to be a health home. If it's part of our responsibility here to say other care coordination models according to legislation are acceptable, are those excluded from that health home and it's only the MLCC?
It's not that it wouldn't be, but based on what we've heard so far from CMS would suggest that we're going to have a hard time convincing them on just the MLCCP. And the MLCCP is the most comprehensive of the long-term care management programs we have. So I think it's going to be a hard sell there. But I think one of the things, and I think even the Home Care Association's proposal begins to get home care providers, long Lombardi plan type providers, more down the path towards more comprehensive. But as I said, you know, our aspiration is even more than just, you know, somebody managing the long-term care benefit. I mean, that's the other thing I just mentioned quickly is why do we have the models we have? To some extent, it's based on the financial incentive that the state has faced, which is we fund long-term care for this, you know, the population, and Medicare funds the acute care services. We had an incentive, financial incentive, to create models to manage that population based on the programs and how they operate. What I think we're hoping to get to, and that's why there's a whole dual office in Medicare and within CMS, is, and their goal is 1 million people in a fully integrated care within a year, that, you know, maybe New York could be a leader in trying to move more of that population into fully coordinated models, which requires not just Lombardi plan providers, but MLCCP plan providers to think much more broadly to begin to bite off, you know, more of the benefit from a care management standpoint.
Okay, Joanne.
I think that might be helpful, at least for me, is to visualize it. And if you were to look at the continuum that you see, starting with fee-for-service, which we all agree is not good, I would define in my own head, candidly, the PACE model as the most comprehensive in terms of people who, in this case, need nursing home care and we're coordinating all that care. Take the other components as you see it, whether it's the CCM, MLCC, health homes. How would you rank them on the continuum from least controlled to most structured? I think that's what I'm having a little hard time. I'm reading a lot of the CCM stuff as actually being above what we currently expect our MLTCs that are just the partial capitation program.
I think you know, for a perfect example, it's aspirational for the MLTCP to begin to think and beyond just the current managed long-term care benefit and think beyond. I mean, I think that's, as I've said, that's our goal, and understanding it's going to take a while to get there, but we want to encourage providers, because I think to provide an incentive for some of these providers to begin or thinking about what would I need to do as an MLTCP or as a Lombardi plan or as a CHA. We have CHAs who are interested in becoming MLTCPs. What do I need to do to evolve my business, what I do, to expand services so I can more completely meet the needs of the people I serve today? And so I think that's what I'm saying is that, you know, you can end up at the CHA sort of at the, you know, at the one end of the perspective, all the way to pace at the other end of perspective, with folks sort of falling in between. But I think the goal is to push everybody up towards that continuum. Now, the question, one question is pace. Pace is a highly prescriptive model. People try it all across the country. Is that the fully integrated model that New York wants? Is that particular model a very sort of, not the insular, but it's a very controlled model? Is that a scalable model? I think that is an open question. Or is it an MLTCP partnering with another plan, or, you know, that does more of the mainstream functions through a coordinated effort to manage the whole person? Or does an MLTCP, you know, expand its services to include? We have MLTCPs today that have mainstream business that are pretty much true. So I think we can end up, at the end of the day, we have a variety of models, which I think would be very exciting if people could choose. And I'll give you a perfect example of a choice, and I'll use all the time. But look at AIDS HIV. Right? We have eight HIV SNPs, or provider-owned, as close to full integration as we have outside of the PACE plans in terms of, and you know, Medicaid product. If I have the AIDS HIV designation and I live in New York City, I can choose an AIDS SNP, or I can choose a mainstream plan. And people are making those choices every single day. Now, we invested a good amount of money and took time to build the AIDS SNPs into what they are today. But they're a fully integrated plan, provider-owned, and built on serving a highly specialized population. But they compete for business every day with mainstream plans who offer, you know, and if I got AIDS HIV, maybe the number one problem I have, not my AIDS diagnosis, but rather my lower back. And I want to be able to see, a specialist for that, and the network of the mainstream plan is more comprehensive. I think if we get to a point where you have a variety of different managed care partners offering a variety of services in a fully integrated fashion, I think that would be a very exciting place to be 5 years from now.
So can I just follow up? I don't feel like I got the question answered tonight. I'm trying to figure out in that continuum where CCM, because we're now talking about guidelines for CCM, so I'm assuming that's different than the guidelines for the MLTCs and the MAP and PACE programs. So when you think about CCM, do you think them as them being more comprehensive in terms of services, with higher risk than the MLTCs, or less so? Because I guess when I interpret it as legislative authority, my reading of what they were trying to accomplish is that there are entities out there, like the long-term home health care program, we're already providing services to 30,000 people a year, should be a care coordination model.
I think the word was may.
May. Okay.
And I think what we're trying to do is to put together principles that would be used to evaluate a variety of models against an MLTCP would be a model that would be evaluated against these principles, or alternatives to MLTCP, of which the Home Care Agency Association has a proposal on the table that in essence would be viewed against these.
Okay, Courtney.
When I look at these, I feel like we keep circling around what your main goal is, which is full integration of care. To me, it doesn't matter so much what that model looks like. Joanne was asking the question of, are we talking about full integration? Are we talking about managed long-term care? Are we talking about health homes? I think what we should do as a group is decide what it is we're looking for in terms of outcomes. So we're looking at reducing the avoidable hospitalizations that you spoke about. We're looking at a person-centered planning process where we have some way to measure the amount that the person is involved in the process. We have people in the least restrictive environment, and we have a baseline now of what that might look like in the future. I feel like we're better off setting out what those outcomes and standards might be rather than trying to determine what the actual structure might look like. I think that should be left up to the marketplace, the providers, and so on, and that the outcomes and goals should drive what it looks like.
That was what the work group that I was going to chair was going to tackle, which is, you know, what are the measures, the performance measures that we need to come up with. That would include what you mentioned, which is making sure we have a person-centered planning process, making sure that people are in the most integrated / least restrictive setting, making sure that we have good results and avoid unneeded hospitalizations to the fullest extent possible. Whatever we think, because
because that goes back to the monitoring. What are we going to monitor whatever these entities look like again? And so this is, to me, very critical to put a real structure in place for the future. And I personally believe that the metrics for long-term care are different from those that pertain in mainstream plans. There's some overlap, but there are some things that are very, very different. Okay, have I missed, yes, Mark, and then Marilyn, and then we're going to move on.
I agree with the quality outcomes and measurements, which are critical, that needs to be embedded as part of those principles. But I'm sure I'm going to go back to what Kathy Scher said relative to the health home and the word responsible versus involved, and then what are the services outside of the person at risk. This needs to be restructured, because I don't know what the word responsible is, and I don't know what the authority goes with it for that CCM for those services that are not part of the benefit package.
I think we agree.
Well,
there's
a
CCM.
Okay.
Yeah. We just need to revise it.
Okay. All right.
And then, we haven't crossed the threshold about whether a CCM is going to be a health home. I mean, that's an open question.
Right.
Okay. I don't think the group's crossed the threshold that just assuming that a CCM is going to be a health home.
Right.
So a health home brings with it a whole bunch of requirements, as Kathy laid out.
Right. And what is the CCM contract with the health home?
Right.
Going back to where Joanne, I thought this going. I thought when we put forth these principles, all of whatever models we come up with would have to meet these principles. That's how I kind of looked at it.
Yep.
Right?
Yep.
Carol, I agree with what you said. It's kind of disturbing to hear that plans do this, large programs do this, take all due care, coordination. So it's not that a new entity could come in and say they do care coordination. And a long-term care plan does it. MLTCs do it. So we're not looking for an entity to do this. We're looking to incorporate what the principles are of CCM into any model.
Right. Mm-hmm. Okay. So I'm going on to five.
Yeah.
The CCM care management must involve the individual and informal support in the development and execution of the care plan to the extent desired by the individual. Eliciting and adhering to the wishes and preferences of individuals and their informal support is a critical component of care plan development. Dave, this was a point you made at the last meeting. Members with capacity should be given the opportunity to participate about the type and quantity of service to be provided. So I can see already that a few people here are regurgitating.
I apologize. The word eliciting, communicating, working with the individual or their designated representative, that's fine. It's the word adhering that I have concerns with. That is a very, very strong word, absent any type of qualifiers or conditions. If I expect A, and I'm asking you, Mary, and Mary, you've got a defined list of benefits, you have a defined list of standards, but I don't care about that. This word adhering to is a very... I think it's not workable.
You have a change?
Carol's going to come up with the word.
Well, part of it's coupled with wishes, because wishes is not necessarily needs.
Yeah.
So
right.
You've got to somehow integrate
the
two.
Wishes and adhering.
Wishes and preferences with regard to the monster needs. It's not whatever they want. It's what they need, and then they have choices around.
Within the confines of
the
benefit.
Within the confines of the benefit. Yeah, so like personal care level one, we now have a cap.
Right.
So it is what it is.
For physical therapy, I want 30 minutes.
But I have to say, I'm going to be the odd woman out on this one. I understand the issue around adhering. I myself have some, discomfort with that. I really do. But I do think when you're dealing with disabled people, their wishes are important. The kind of life that they want, their engagement in the community, want to be active. You know, I don't know if you say that's a need or a wish. I'm not sure. I don't want to get into the magic. But to me, it's an important consideration. And, you know, this is a long-term care system isn't only medically driven. It's driven by other things than just a medical condition. And I want to be sure that we capture that.
But supposing we had it, if you love that, you had it consistent with the need.
That then, and right, and preferences, then I'm comfortable with that. Right?
And you incorporate that
right.
As well.
Okay, Joe.
I think the wishes and preferences are important. Because ultimately, it's not just about meeting clinical needs, it's about building a care plan that enables someone to have the quality of life that they want to have.
Right.
And there are differences in what people want, and that needs to inform what that care system is.
Okay, Melody.
I don't mean to be a one-note person, but there needs to be somewhere in the principles where we make the statement that complying with the Olmstead decision is the goal. We need to have something in the principles that makes the statement that complying with the Olmstead decision is a goal. So it's about the individual's needs and preferences, but it's also about their rights, as you acknowledged. And it goes back to my same question before, what in the state's responsibility is going to be transferred to the individuals or to the plans and the providers who are dealing with individuals? We haven't grappled with that issue.
Number 8. Yeah, look at
number 8. The most integrated setting appropriate.
Thank you. I'm so focused on starting at the beginning.
Okay. All right. Anything?
I'll get back to that. Thanks.
Any other? These are good points. On 6, on 5.
Right. Yeah. The only other thing, Carol, I think, and we kind of, you know, healthcare. We've all been in positions with healthcare where, for some reason, we would love control of it because maybe we're too sick, maybe we just don't know what questions to ask. And I think TCM is responsible. But informing people of their choices and what's available. But I think it's an ultimate right for an individual to say, no, I don't agree with this, or no, you say I need 10 hours, but let me try it for 8 hours a day, and then if it doesn't work, we'll talk again. So I think that somewhere in this experience, the thing I think that Carol is saying, and Melanie and I'm saying, what is the responsibility of the requirement of the plan to really do client-centered planning, which means it's about what I, as a consumer, feel is necessary in my life, and what the plan is responsible for is what services do you need in order to do this.
Okay. Well, Courtney had raised that before. Dave, why don't
you? Well, I guess I would just echo that. I'd rather see it say person-centered and must involve the individual, and that
okay.
Is the heart of what we're trying to say is that their wishes are central, not an add-on to what we're trying to provide.
All right. Betty, you have the last word on this one.
I just think that we have to, somewhere in the view of things, look at reasonable and appropriate, because as someone else said, you know, wishes are not necessarily needs, but we do need to take into consideration what is reasonable. I'm not going to get a massage every day because I wish it makes me feel better. That's not a reasonable
thing. All right. So now let me do a time check here. This is what I would like to do. I'd like to have us break for lunch at 12:30. So that's in 23 minutes. From now, I'm going to ask you at lunch to please, each and every one of you, come to let Eli and me know which subcommittee you're interested in participating in, so we can do that during our half-hour lunch break. So we're going to forge ahead until then. I'm going on to number 6. CCM members will have a choice of provider for all benefit package services. Members should be able to select among several providers of service. BCMs should have a network that takes into account the cultural and linguistic needs of the population to be enrolled. However, CCM should not be prevented from operating when market forces, lack of availability, or unwillingness to contract preclude a CCM from offering choice, or perhaps in some instances, a particular service. Members should have the ability to receive services from an out-of-network provider if no provider is available in-network that can adequately meet the needs of the member. Alan.
Would you entertain adding one word? Where would be only before the if and the last one?
Only
out of network and out of network provider only if.
Okay. Any other comments on this?
The only thing is that the plan is working in population. The providers have that there is an intervention competency for that.
Okay.
Good point.
Good
point.
Yeah, that's
yep.
a good point.
Yep.
Okay, yes, Kate.
When you're looking upstate, there's a lot of reasons, especially to look at the there's only one in an area, and they really can't even handle a lot of population and take too many.
As far as that choice.
Yeah. Will the Department of Health be able to assist, you know, and, you know, manage long-term care plans or CCMs in those areas to offer agencies that might be able to cross borders if they're contracted or something to that effect?
Yeah,
that's a good. That's a great issue.
Right, right.
That we've been talking about the CON changes as you move into this managed care environment, how the whole CON process needs to be looked at in a different way. So
we should come up with guidelines for the State Department of Health.
Exactly.
Hey, appropriately.
There you go.
We're not the
staff.
Customer friendly.
Okay.
Number seven.
Wait.
Oh, I'm sorry, Mark. An out-of-network in-state provider.
Good point.
I could want something in North Dakota because
okay.
it's a better place.
Yeah, but what if
yeah,
I live
on the border?
The question of choice for all benefit package services, care management coordination is one of them. And supposing, you know, I mean, I may want to choose something that may not be part of the entity that is doing the care management coordination. Do I have the ability? On what basis would I have the ability to leave one plan and go to another plan if I like that plan better? You don't want to create a shopping spree where you can go from plan to plan basically because of that. And two, if the organization has care coordination capability and is responsible for that, do you really want that to be an option? Be able to go outside of a plan to get something someplace else?
Well, I don't know. I always assumed that care coordination and care management had to be provided by the CCM, but maybe that was the wrong assumption. Could they outsource that? And do they have to give beneficiaries a choice?
On mainstream, I lack all care coordination when I send somebody out of state. I'm pretty much finished. I can't even try to even get the medical record. So this out-of-network provider, I understand the means to provide the service, but there's got to be some conditions or qualifiers within that.
Right, which I think could be accomplished
within
the contract.
It's been done when we did this issue with people with disabilities in mainstream managed care. There is a condition that's defined when you can.
So, Mark and Valencia, how are you thinking about it? Did the CCM have to provide care management itself?
I'm not sure we made that decision, frankly. Some plans do contract with it, right? But I think the question
is... the quality
is,
of it is more important.
Right. I think the real question is, will people have choice within of care management organizations? And the answer is yes.
inherently, unless we, you know, the rule exception, I guess, in certain areas. But generally speaking, the goal would be that people would be able to choose from multiple different plans. That would, in essence, all be required to meet the same requirements. But some of those plans, as I said, may have special approaches to care management that may be more attractive. And I think the idea of allowing those plans to compete is, in essence, you know, part of the deal we're trying to accomplish.
Kathy?
Just a point. Are we talking here just about the long-term care benefit package or potential more comprehensive package, or both?
It's going to evolve.
Then you've got to bring in the concept of emergency services.
Right. Yeah, I think we should. I mean, most of the focus here is on the implementation of managed long-term care. Yeah.
I think we should stay with managed long-term care. Just that there will be other issues down the road, but that's complicated enough.
Not for now, yeah.
Right. Okay, number seven. CCM will use a standardized assessment tool to drive care plan development. Data should be submitted to New York State. CCM should use the same standardized assessment tool as other long-term care entities, the UAS-NY, when available, to be used for initial assessment, scheduled reassessment, and other reassessments resulting from a change in condition. Data submitted to the state will be available to compare and evaluate entities to create transparency about CCM service delivery. Any questions about that? Yes. Okay.
I know we're moving towards a standardized tool. My concern is when using, how can you use the same tool to talk about different populations with different needs? That in many of the tools that are used in assessment, since the majority of home care consumers, personal care consumers, are frail elderly, it talks into account falls, it talks about safety. A population of people with physical disabilities, they necessarily have what they're all going to determine what the hours of care are and what the services are. And if we've talked about in the principles that the plans have to meet the needs of specific populations, CMS, well, how do you use, you know, my needs, if you score me on high score low for feeding, because it talks nothing about not feeding yourself. It talks about, can I prepare the food? Do I need someone to bring it to me and prepare it? Doesn't give me extra points.
Yeah, no, those are all great questions. And, you know, as we move forward on this UAS in New York, we're going to come brief you, and we should talk to you as well as all the other disability advocacy organizations. Because we think that the UAS in New York will be robust enough and be tested. We want to test it for that population. So we're very aware of your of the disability concerns. We're taking it into consideration, and we want to come talk to you about all that. Those are great concerns.
Okay. Yes, Mark.
I'm okay with the assessments and the standardization and the reassessments. I'm confused of why the last piece is embedded there with the data. Data is going to be important for the state for a variety of purposes, not including but not limited to quality and cost, as well as public information, as you're currently doing on Main Street. I'd probably have it as a separate guiding principle as opposed to getting it confused with the assessment and reassessment.
Okay.
Because I think the real value here is to make sure that the assessment is being applied uniformly.
Right.
So that's, a uniform assessment loses some of its uniformity if it's not applied uniformly.
Okay. All right. So number eight, CCM care planning will seek to provide services in the most integrated setting appropriate to the needs of qualified individuals with disabilities. Consistent with the federal OMSTED decision, this gets to the right issue, Melanie, which you raised. Care planning should seek to provide care in the best setting to match the needs of members, engage the members in decision-making, and address quality of life. Okay?
Well,
now everyone knows how my memory doesn't extend to the second page of the list here. But my point that I would make here would be is the statement of we'll speak to. This is the legal right of individuals to live in the community. So the question remains, how does the state transfer that responsibility to plans and providers? How does it impact their decision-making when they have an individual in front of them? The right doesn't go away. The responsibility of the state doesn't go away. Providers want to know, what do they do? It's not just about the individual's needs. It's about their rights.
Well, in essence, if you imagine a world where the entire long-term care population is enrolled into managed long-term care, the state's roles, responsibilities remain the same, as you say. But in essence, the way that the state implements its responsibilities is primarily through these contracts with these entities who are responsible for ensuring that the homestead decision is enforced.
Right. So what's in the contract is what it's all about.
Absolutely.
So how is that process going to happen? Is that part of what we're doing here? Are we?
I think the idea is that these guiding principles, because the contracts are complex, these guiding principles are in essence designed to weigh, not only when we're weighing models, but weigh the requirements. Do the contracts, are the contracts consistent with the guiding principles? And that is key and fundamental.
Okay, Mark?
I'm sorry. I'm okay with, I'm not familiar with the Olmstead decision, but having said that, I don't know what the word seek means or how it will be evaluated. To seek to provide in the care of that engaging. The word seek, there should be a requirement that it will definitely be there, consistent with the benefit packages established by the state, and should seek or be engaged in those that are not. But I don't know, you know, if I go to a fair hearing issue, and I'm not.
So you can take the word seek too, and you can take it out.
Yep, exactly.
Should provide.
Good correction.
Should provide care.
Providing
care.
Within, within the benefits. The word seek is very.
And change best to most integrated setting.
Yeah,
okay.
But just consistent with the benefits package.
Okay.
I just think about that. But now I was saying about the state and the local thing. First of all, one comment and what I'm trying to make is, I was trying to say if this is the best thing. My own state right gives me that choice. So who's going to make that determination? I am a different.
That's where the whole appeal thing, you know.
So, and to go to Melanie's point, right now, if there is an issue, the local social service district does the inherent. But, you know, since they have been removed from the line, what is your right?
Well, that's Eli's work group.
Right, okay. Yep.
I think he just volunteered here.
Right.
Right.
Okay.
How do you deal with the scale of the project?
Right, that's a very.
You know, the social service
right.
Is. Now, smaller
entities
or even over.
Right, but again, if we're talking about choice, it more than the kind of research out and you know, if it's, I mean, I don't know if I should
go in there. Okay, we're going to do number 9 as our last one before lunch.
Should be changed to will in number 8.
No, I think you should. Okay, I'm on to number 9, our last one before lunch. CCM will be evaluated to determine the extent to which it has achieved anticipated goals and outcomes and to drive quality improvement in payment. Data will be submitted and evaluated. This is sort of your point, Mark, of pulling out the other part.
Yeah,
on an ongoing basis to determine the success of the CCM, data will include not be limited to financial reports, provide a network, consumer satisfaction, grievances and appeals, care outcomes, and encounter data. The CCM will use its own data and information to develop and conduct quality improvement projects.
I'd also include regulatory compliance.
Okay.
Got it. It's like sitting next to this thing.
It's ripping off.
Any other comments on this, Carol?
Service use, because one of the repeat issues today had to do with institutional placement over home and community base. So this is one of the areas you would get at that and monitor.
Because, like, one idea along those lines is even for services technically not within the control of the managed long-term care plan, like hospitalization, it would be useful information for plans to, and we may want to financially incentivize through pay for performance or others for plans even before full integration to begin to work with their long-term care providers.
I think that's exactly the right direction. And to note that unlike on the acute care side where it exists and you can refine it and import it in components, this is more a build than a
absolutely, it is a build.
That's your subcommittee.
Right. Yes, Doug.
Yeah, just in number seven, it sort of has the public availability component built in. Just add that on to number
public.
Nine.
Okay.
So the public is to separate data from the data piece from number seven.
Right. And you put it all together.
Right.
And can we make sure it's in a consumer friendly way for
All right, Melanie.
Collecting data on how well the plans are complying with the Olmstead decisions integration mandate.
All right, so let me just remind you of the three subcommittees. So number one is on what we were just talking about. What should we be measuring and what should be publicly disclosed so that people can make educated decisions, et cetera, and the state can monitor and determine the success of managed long-term care and the CCM. The second is the whole issue of appeals and fair hearing, which Eli is going to share and which has come up in many guises today. And how do we balance the needs of the system with the consumer protection? And the third will be the kind of shared cross work group effort to take a look at what the role should be of the local entities, the counties, in determining eligibility and enrollment in the future long-term care system that we're creating here. So I'd like each one of the work group members to participate in one of these three subcommittees, and I'd like you to give thought and let us know which of the three that you'd like to participate in. So we will break. We will resume at 1 o'clock. Thank you very much.
And lunch is for I, so.
Perfect. Whether it should be appeals or fair hearing for local districts.
The leader has disconnected. The conference will be terminated in 2 minutes. The leader has turned lecture off, and your lines have been unmuted.
The leader has disconnected. The conference will now end.